ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I've always loved medieval history, and one of the things I love the most about it is that amid all that blood and horror and pestilence, you sometimes run into a lovely story that illustrates a pivotal moment. And I read the story that in the year 972 AD, a marriage was arranged between a prince of the Holy Roman Empire and a Byzantine princess from Constantinople named Theophano. And the two of them were married in St. Peter's in Rome, and afterwards they sat down to a raucous wedding feast. Theophano was served a plate of food, and then she did something that astonished the revelers. She produced from her gown a dainty little double-pronged golden fork and lifted the food from the plate to her mouth. Now, in Western Europe, even at a royal table, food was consumed noisily and with the hands. Some of the wedding guests saw at once that the use of such an implement would avoid unnecessary mess on the table and on the clothes, but others saw the fork as a symbol of effete Eastern decadence and would later denounce the fork as an ungodly implement. Banquets probably became much less fun after the fork, but I don't think too many people would want to live in a world without an innovation like cutlery or other inventions that have changed the world, like the polio vaccine or chocolate donuts. But on the other hand, many of the men who invented the atom bomb eventually came to wish they'd never brought such a thing into the world. And many of the researchers working on artificial intelligence are troubled by their work right now. Andrew Lee is back on Conversations today. Andrew is a Member of Parliament, a Federal Government Minister, and a former Professor of Economics. And he's been diving deeply into the whole great, big, long history of human innovation, from the wheel to artificial intelligence. And he wants to explode some myths about how these things come into the world and how they change it. Andrew's new book is called The Shortest History of Innovation. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thanks, Richard. Great to be with you.
Now, you begin with a story about penicillin. The antibiotic properties of penicillin were discovered a century ago by Alexander Fleming. Now, just first of all, give me the standard story we're often given about Fleming's discovery of these properties in penicillin.
So, Richard, the standard story is that penicillin is the result of a lone British inventor, Alexander Fleming, who returns to his lab after a holiday in 1928 and discovers penicillin has emerged in a petri dish. It turns out, though, that there's more to it than that, that while Fleming noticed penicillin, he wasn't able to figure out how to scale it into anything useful. And it took another decade and a team, including an Aussie, Howard Florey, who worked out how to extract, stabilise and test penicillin. They first did it in mice, then in humans. They scaled it up using US chemical engineers, deep tank fermentation methods, and then were able to take advantage of wartime urgency in order to scale up penicillin into a mass-produced wonder drug that we know it as today.
So this is a bit of a puncturing of the myth of the lone genius. And all those stories we often grow up with, like that story of Isaac Newton watching an apple fall from the tree and from that deducing the laws of gravity, which is almost certainly not true, that story. So many of these stories love this myth of the lone genius, but that's not right at all, is it?
Individual stories capture the imagination, but they often mischaracterise what's going on with innovation. Those eureka moments are startlingly rare in the true story of innovation, which has less to do with a mouldy dish, an overflowing bath, or an apple falling onto a head, and more to do with teams of people working together and tinkering over time in order to create innovations that have changed our world.
We all know these stories of the spark invention, that light bulb moment, but you say there's three elements to this success that turns a mere invention into an innovation. Tinkering, teams and trade. Take me through those three aspects, please.
Well, tinkering is the way in which innovation arises from experimentation and often just sheer luck. Thomas Edison said he tested 6,000 materials in order to find the most suitable filament in a light globe. When Marie Curie was attempting to produce a gram of radioactive material, she had to start with a ton of pitch blend. We see often these industrial labs, Bell Labs, 3M are some of the most famous. in which groups of people from often different disciplines are brought together. Teams work best when they're diverse, when they're not just groups of brilliant clones, but when they bring in different ideas and different perspectives. As one innovation scholar says, if you want to have cool technology, it's better to be social than smart. And then trade is the idea, Richard, as you know so well, that innovative societies tend to be ones that are open to the rest of the world. So we see in ancient Rome, that period of the Pax Romana in which Rome is engaging through commerce, that it tends to be more innovative. We see moments in Chinese history in which the dynasties that are most open to engagement with the rest of the world, such as the Han Dynasty, were far more vibrant and innovative than periods in which China was more closed off to the rest of the world, such as after the Heijin, the sea ban that restricted maritime trade.
Societies that tend to innovate throughout history, they do have these large migrant populations living among them. Do you think that's a factor as well?
You certainly see the predominance of migrants in areas like Silicon Valley, in moments in which civilizations have welcomed others in. The Library of Alexandria worked not only because it aimed to catalogue the world's books, or scrolls as they then were, but also because it welcomes visiting scholars to come in and share their ideas. One scholar talks about these as novelty-rich revolutions. 5th century Athens, 12th century Song China, 17th century Mughal India, or 18th century Enlightenment Europe. And those tend to be times and places in which cultures are open to new ideas coming across the border. Breakthroughs often involve bringing together ideas that were previously disparate. One innovation scholar calls it recombinant innovation. Another one just calls it ideas having sex. It's when you bring together the notions from different spaces. Sometimes it's people who are facing discrimination and traditional employment who become innovators because they're constrained in one particular area. There's a lovely line in John Coltrane where he says, innovators always seek to revitalise, extend and reconstruct the status quo. Quite often they're the reject, outcast, sub-citizens of the very societies to which they bring so much sustenance.
That's very well said. Coltrane said that. That's amazing.
In a letter to a friend. It's a lovely line.
This is a history you've written of human innovation, so let's dial it right back and start with the wheel, which is as good a place as any to start. Where do we find the earliest evidence so far of people using wheels?
It's in an area which is now Ukraine's Carpathian Mountains, and it emerges from miners who are looking to extract copper. This is the Copper Age, and copper is being used for making tools and cookware. And people are digging deep underground in order to extract the ore. But dragging ore out is exhausting work. And so they come upon the idea of devising a cart that rolls on four circular wooden discs, with each pair connected by a solid axle. That's an early start, but it doesn't turn very well because the wheels are fixed to the axles on both sides. So then you get these little tinkering innovations that occur subsequently. Independently rotating wheels, eventually spoked wheels, and ultimately carts on which people carry their possessions, transforming the way in which nomads live and move.
So the cart, the wheel and the cart allow people suddenly to pull up sticks, put all their kids and all the belongings into a cart and move. And maybe that's one of the biggest transformations that comes about from the wheel.
Absolutely. So suddenly you see people across the Black Sea plain using wagons, which have covered bark canopies. They can sleep in those wagons. They can carry children and the elderly. And you can use oxen in order to pull the cart around. Suddenly now people are able to own more things than they can just carry on their backs and those of their animals. And so those possessions become larger and people are more willing to invest in tools because they know they can take those tools with them. Wheels are extraordinarily important in some cultures and surprisingly unimportant in others. And so if you're talking about the hilly communities of Papua New Guinea, for example, wheels are much less useful as an innovation and so much less used.
I've just been reading a lot about ancient Mesopotamia lately, Andrew, and you can see what a transformative effect the wheel has with the spoked wheel, you get the chariot. The chariots are kind of like the tank of the ancient world. They radically transform the battlefield and they allow the Assyrians to take over what was for them the known world. But it stops short at the mountains and the deserts. So there's limitations there to how far the wheel can get you. Is this why the wheel appears in some places and not others?
That's right. It's just a simple matter of practicality. The wheel is far more useful in the flat plains of Mesopotamia than it is in the hilly communities of Papua New Guinea. And so you see those Pacific Island communities doing extraordinary innovation in terms of their ocean-going canoes and navigation, but relatively little in an area like the wheel, which is much less useful. And you have other areas such as ancient Egypt, in which the wheel was used for military chariots, but it wasn't used for making many of the pyramids, where the blocks were dragged rather than brought on wheeled vehicles.
The wheel is one thing, but a wheel really needs a road, doesn't it?
It does indeed, and without good roads, then wheels are much less useful. And so the Roman Empire makes more use of wheels because they're more willing to build roads. And then as the Roman Empire falls and the roads fall into disuse, wheel transport becomes less valuable. And you can even go to relatively recent periods in which areas like Mile End Road in London or the road in Washington, D.C. from the Capitol to the White House were essentially muddy tracks, in which travelling on the back of a horse was often a better way of getting around than using any form of wheeled transport.
What's the larger point here? Is this an idea of a technological partnership?
That's right, that innovations build on one another, and that having electricity then enables computerisation, and innovations are able to increment upon one another. And so there's certain ideas that emerge together. You have multiple people filing patents for the telephone at the same time, for example, because the technology has become possible at that moment for innovators to build. So yes, innovation is the product of brilliant minds, but it's also the product of circumstances and the technologies that come before.
When you go through an airport these days, you see a lot of lightbox ads promising innovative financial solutions, innovation here, innovation there. But it's a word with a bit of a mixed reputation these days. You can say the word innovation around a lot of places and a lot of people roll their eyes. It just sounds like something that's going to come in and make someone else rich and cost me my job at some point. And it's worth making the point, I think, that for much of human history, certainly throughout the Middle Ages, the word innovation was a slur. It was seen as a bad thing, like, you know, tacking on a cheap 70s renovation to a lovely old house. What do you make of this word innovation and its kind of mixed meaning for different people?
Yes, it really is only in the last couple of centuries that innovation has been thought of as a good thing. Charles I in the 1600s prohibited innovation. John Calvin wrote in the 1500s, it's the duty of private men to obey and not to make innovations of states after their own will. The Tokugawa shogunate in Japan imposed strict limits on innovation, and you saw even Edmund Burke, as the Industrial Revolution is getting underway, pushing back against the idea of innovation and being concerned about the societal disruption it will cause. So I think there's always been a little bit of a tension in the way in which innovation emerges, with people being concerned that that is going to undermine the foundations of society itself if we move too quickly technologically.
Can you explain the difference between what's called a sustaining innovation and a disruptive innovation?
So a sustaining innovation is essentially an innovation in which we're just tweaking things along. So think of screw-top wine bottles, for example. A disruptive innovation is one that fundamentally changes the landscape. Think of the printing press and what that was able to do to transform society. And these two different kinds of innovation, we benefit from both. But those disruptive innovations set up a further cascade of changes, just like the internet has done in our lifetimes.
Perhaps the earliest one of these is when humans harness the agricultural revolution in Mesopotamia and in India to begin with, and things really start to move. Take me through some of the changes that agriculture unlocks across that part of the world.
Farming fundamentally changes the way in which people move through life. You have that moment in which societies move from being fundamentally nomadic to being settled societies. That's easier in some parts of the world than others. If you're looking to domesticate animals, then it helps to have animals like cattle and pigs, not animals like kangaroos around you. And you also see the movement towards settled agriculture and to planting crops rather than picking the crops that are out there already. That allows surpluses to build up and allows ultimately the specialisation, which is fundamental to modern societies, in which people aren't just jacks of all trades, jills of all trades, but are focused on particular things. You get property rights, you get what's called the Neolithic package, which increases population size and leads to urbanisation and groups where suddenly you don't know everyone in your group. There is a larger city that you're part of.
I mean, I love cities. I'm a city guy generally. And without agriculture, you don't get cities. You just don't get that concentration of people. You don't get writing. And, you know, we all love the written word and what a marvellous thing that is. Yet there's a kind of debate that goes on with historians these days that says people were generally healthier and happier as hunter-gatherers. Their diets were more nutritious. They lived longer. They were taller. They didn't have to live with governments telling them what to do so much. On the other hand, their lives were often more interrupted by warfare and kind of lethal warfare. What do you think of all that, Andrew?
Yes, we don't have great data on happiness, but certainly we know that they tended to be shorter as a result of being able to look at the skeletons they left behind. And we think that part of that is because when you're in a city, you tend to consume most of your calories from a few starchy crops rather than having the diverse nuts, berries and animals that nomadic peoples had. And we know that there is a greater spread of disease in some of those early cities since sanitation doesn't keep up with urbanisation. But it's great for innovation because you have a whole lot of people proximate to one another. Inventors can build on one another's discoveries. And that continues through to today. So on average, the innovation scholars estimate that a city of 5 million is 3 times as innovative per person as a town of 100,000 people. And that's why innovators tend to set up in big cities, because it's easier to get access to the skills, the brain power, and the diverse team that a successful innovation needs.
We get writing and mathematics from Mesopotamia. We get urban planning from early India, the pyramids, mass architectural projects from Egypt. The Greeks bring us philosophy and literature. The Romans are interesting. They have several innovations early on in law, in government and engineering, in military organisation, and then they kind of stop innovating. Why is it thought that some societies like the Roman Empire stop innovating?
Well, partly, Richard, it's that Rome had a lot of labour. And so when labour is plentiful and there's plenty of slaves and low-wage workers around, then there's less need to innovate on labour-saving devices. So you see a lot of Roman innovation in the area of public infrastructure. We think particularly of the aqueducts, ways in which those baths were delivered. They were able to have hot running water 2,000 years ago. But we don't see as much innovation in other areas. And there's some thought that perhaps too much of the innovation of the Romans and sometimes even the Greeks was focused on little toys rather than applications that were really changing the lives of the bulk of people.
Having ready access to massive amounts of slave labour surely had something to do with it, because that disparity is often made between the United States in the 19th century. And one of the reasons why the Civil War happened was the North didn't have slavery. It was kind of compelled by the absence of slavery to innovate and create labour-saving devices, where the South, the elites in the South absolutely did not. Is slavery a big factor in stopping innovation?
Look, I think it certainly is in ancient Rome. You just don't see those big innovations in shipping and agriculture and textiles in the way in which you do in times when labour is more scarce. You have also the example in that period, first, second centuries after the birth of Christ, of Hero of Alexandria, who comes up with these extraordinary inventions. a coin-operated vending machine, a steam engine, a wind wheel.
Sorry, just hold it for a coin-operated vending machine in the ancient world?
It's extraordinary, a 2,000-year-old coin-operated vending machine. But Hero of Alexandria essentially rolls them out as party tricks. So he has a vending machine. His vending machine dispenses water for ablutions. His steam engine doesn't power anything. His wind wheel operates a musical organ. He's tinkering for fun, but he doesn't have a team of people to take up his ideas, and he doesn't have the trade in ideas that would really allow his innovations to take off and transform his world.
In the medieval era, it's a dark age in Western Europe. There's a lack of innovation. The aqueducts break down, the roads break down of the Roman world. But in the Islamic world, in China, in India, there's this golden age of technology. I really love this Persian scholar in the court of the caliphate by the name of Al-Khwarizmi. Tell me a bit about him, please, Andrew.
Al-Khwarizmi is extraordinary in terms of how he thinks through what we now know as algebra, a name which comes from his book, and algorithms, which comes from his name. So he thinks through the way in which you need to balance equations. People remember from school what you do to the left of the equation, you need to do the right of the equation. He does work that helps disseminate the decimal system and ways of solving linear and quadratic equations. So every time a student solves for x or applies the quadratic formula or follows an algorithm, really they're engaging with concepts that go all the way back to Al-Khwarizmi.
We use what is often called Arabic numerals from day to day, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. But they're really Indian numbers, aren't they? It's an Indian numeral system that was invented in India that the Arabs picked up and encountered and incorporated. It's another example of how there's this kind of interchange of ideas, one innovation builds on another. Because, my God, Indian numbers are a real advance on the old Roman numeral system.
It certainly is. And one reason that the Islamic Golden Age is such a success is because societies of that time are much more open and cosmopolitan than European societies are in the Middle Ages. You have this tradition of the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. Muslims are encouraged to read the Quran, and you have paper factories churning out bound books across the Islamic world. Baghdad's House of Worship is a major library and a centre for scholarship. And so this really is a very exciting time for innovation in the Islamic world at a period where European innovation is in abeyance.
Gunpowder was invented in China, but it's the Europeans that extend its use into firearms. How did that get passed on and developed from one end of the Eurasian continent to the other?
Yes, the Chinese begin using gunpowder for what they call fire lances, which are handheld devices that propel shrapnel just a couple of metres. But then somewhere around 1300 or so, Europeans start to pull ahead. And partly that's just because China is a whole lot more peaceful and the Europeans are spending their time fighting one another. China has what's known as the Ming Peace, whereas Europeans are going through the Hundred Years' Wars, the Italian Wars, the Ottoman Habsburg Wars, the French Wars, the War of the Roses, the 30-Year Wars, the 80-Year Wars. Millions of people are being slaughtered on the European continent. But in the process, Europeans are refining the tools of war, using gunpowder in order to make handheld firearms, which are far more sophisticated than the fire lances that preceded them.
You see, I would have thought that you need stability, political stability for innovation. You need, you know, strong rule of law, all those kinds of things to have innovation. But this story seems to break that rule, doesn't it? Sometimes instability can be the instigator of well, in this case, quite an ugly innovation.
Yes, and I suppose what we're missing in this conversation is that there would be other sorts of innovation that found it hard to flourish. Perhaps artists or other creatives weren't able to do their work as effectively through the course of these conflicts. So you think about the Library of Alexandria being burned down potentially as a result of conflict, and the fact that the Florentine Golden Age really only takes off in a period of peace. So war is good for warlike innovations. It may be bad for other more peaceful innovations.
You've got two innovations you've listed as transformative that seem, on the face of it, or seem to me anyway, to be pretty innocuous. The stirrup and the heavy plough. Why were these seemingly innocuous inventions so transformative to the world?
Well, the stirrup is incredibly important because it gives civilian riders more ability to control their horses, but particularly for military riders, it allows them to take on foot soldiers. Once you have stirrups and heavy saddles in place, then a small group of horsemen are able to dominate a much larger group of foot soldiers. So it shifts the balance towards cavalry, and then in turn shifts the balance towards a feudal system of lords, vassals and fiefs, in which it's easier for an elite to subjugate a larger group of peasants.
So politically you get feudalism to some degree from the stirrup. And what about the heavy plough? Why is that a transformative innovation?
So the heavy plough, the difference between the heavy plough and what preceded it is that it's able to turn the soil over. Previously, you had what's known as scratch ploughs, which are essentially just dragging an implement through and building a single furrow. A heavy plough has what's called a mould board, which is turning the soil over. That's particularly important for the soils of northern Europe, which have a little bit more clay. It mattered less in the Mediterranean, where effectively you've got light, dry soils. And then the heavy plough, it allows better weed control, it allows better drainage, better cross ploughing, and it can be dragged behind horses. And so it's really important in terms of what it does to social structure. Societies which developed plough-driven agriculture tended to have more traditional gender norms because the heavy plough advantaged men who could control it more than scratch agriculture, which was more egalitarian.
You talk a bit about navigation and sailing, and there's the innovation of the three-masted ship and the compass. The navigation tools start to massively improve. This starts with Chinese sailors using a wet compass. How does it go from there, Andrew?
So if we go back to before we had compasses, sailors were sailing based on the stars, which is fine until it gets cloudy and then you're in real strife. So the wet compass has a needle that floats in water, and then that moves on to the dry compass, which essentially is a needle above a compass card. That's easier if you've got bad weather and the boat is moving a little. The compass effectively allows people to sail much more safely without getting lost in harsh environments. You have huge numbers of shipwrecks pre-compass, which are caused by an inability to navigate. And now with the compass, people are able to sail to foreign lands and pick up not only goods, but ideas. And so the compass, in some sense, is an idea that enables more ideas.
And, of course, the transmission of disease at the same time. There's always swings and roundabouts here.
That's absolutely right. And you see this particularly when the so-called old world meets the new world, because Europe had many more dense cities, it had developed many more virulent diseases. So when European settlers made their way to the Americas, they carried worse diseases across than they picked up, and millions died as a result of the diseases that they brought.
The introduction of the printing press is one of the all-time most transformative innovations. Printing press with movable type. And suddenly we have a great proliferation of books, and eventually newspapers, and this huge educative process. Suddenly mass politics becomes possible, and then the whole reinvention of the Christian religion. This is where you get Protestantism. And then the immense violence that nonetheless comes from that in Europe with the wars of religion, 30 Years' War. I wonder if you're really struck by the enormous blessing of the printing press and at the same time the immense price that humanity paid for such a blessing. Should we hang that on the printing press, or should we hang that on ourselves, Andrew, I wonder?
It does look like the printing press is doing a lot of the work here. I mean, you see, when Gutenberg brings together the idea of the screw press, which had been used for winemaking, into the notions that had been around in China previously for movable type, he creates an extraordinary breakthrough. There's one estimate that in the 50 years after he invents the printing press, more books are published than in the previous 1,000 years. You've mentioned the Reformation and the way in which encouraging ordinary people to read the Bible then creates the spread of literacy. Suddenly ideas can travel faster and inventors are able to build on the shoulders of others in a way in which they're simply not, when they can't get access to books.
You make the point that in China and in the Ottoman Empire, they looked at the effect the printing press was having in Western Europe and Europe as a whole, and went, we're going to stop that. We're going to constrain the number of printing presses that are available in our empires. But what kind of a price do they pay for trying to clamp down on the use of the printing press?
There's one story that in China, a man who printed the emperor's name was executed and his entire family was enslaved. The Ottoman Empire caps the number of printing presses, and the result of this, is, just as you've said, is to stem the flow of ideas that comes from the printing press. You have a different notion in Europe, more of an emphasis on individual inquiry, humanist scholarship, religious reform, and so the printing press falls on much more fertile soil and has more of an impact of spurring innovation.
How about the clock, the invention of the clock? Is this a classic case of how humans invent a tool that then becomes our master, like something that's supposed to work for us that we then work to, like emails?
That's right. So initially, clocks were powered by a falling weight, but that's not very useful if you'd like to have a portable clock, for example, one that carries on a ship. So the key invention in spring-powered clocks was something known as the fusée, which is like a cone-shaped pulley that effectively allows the tension to be constant as the spring unwinds. Suddenly, ships can carry clocks with them, which helps allow sailors determine longitude, a key issue in terms of their navigation. And as you've said, Richard, transforms people's attitude towards time. Suddenly, you have church services, school lessons, and work days that are able to start at a particular time. We move from clocks which are accurate to within an hour, then a quarter of an hour. And then as the clock develops, historians have noted you can see differences in how time is divvied up. Eventually you get to minutes, and then by mid-1500s you get to seconds. And that additional precision is important in terms of everything from planning travel to figuring out how we spend our leisure time.
When we get to that period known as the Enlightenment, suddenly Europe becomes very much the centre of innovation. We get the telescope, and that allows people to deduce planetary motion. We get the microscope to discover the existence of microbes, the barometer for weather forecasting. We have Isaac Newton deducing the laws of gravity and motion, and the problem of longitude solved, as you say, by high-precision clocks. China, which had been in the lead, technological lead for centuries, fell behind radically. What's the theory on how that happened?
Yeah, so China's inability to lead in the Enlightenment has been a puzzle, first noted by a guy called Joseph Needham. And the Needham question is, why was it that China came up with paper, gunpowder, printing, compasses, mechanical clocks, movable types, sternpost rudder, and many more inventions, and yet failed to lead the world in innovation by the time you came up to the Enlightenment? And I think part of the notion is that there's a great centralization in China in which there's an emphasis on the memorization of traditional Confucian texts over independent inquiry. You succeed in China in some sense by showing your mastery over classical literature, whereas Europe is much more open to people like Galileo who are showing their mastery of the new. And the scientific revolution is therefore more likely to emerge in a place like Europe. Suddenly you have the technology and lens grinding that allows you to look at the stars, and people learn more about the stars in our universe. And you have the technology that allows you to look at the very small, and suddenly people learn about cells and what insects look like and the like.
Why does the Industrial Revolution, which gives us the steam engine, the spinning jenny, railways, mass production, begin in England, this kind of muddy offshore island, not terribly important in the scheme of things? How does this place become the centre of this revolution that powers them towards an empire?
There's a bunch of answers to that. One is that they've got a tradition of tinkering and playing with gadgets. Another is they've got a lot of coal that's located next to big cities. And a third is that they have a whole lot of artisans with really good mechanical skills developed through an apprenticeship system. The UK also has a pretty stable parliamentary system, meaning that an innovator is able to file a patent, create a company, raise money from financial backers, and market their idea to the public, typically without having to pay a bribe, which isn't true of many other countries in that period. British innovators effectively are able to spend more time greasing gears than greasing palms. And so they're able to see the sort of tinkering in innovation which fosters innovation through textiles, watchmaking, and ultimately flows into innovation such as the steam engine.
You know, at the time, the monarchies of France and Russia were often admired for their grandeur, and you have Louis XIV, the Sun King, going and saying, "I am the state, l'état, c'est moi, I am it, the be-all and end-all of everything," whereas the British monarchy is more constrained. Its power is constrained by Parliament and, to a lesser extent, by the courts. I wonder if that's such an important factor here.
That's absolutely right. So you've got the 1688 regime change, the so-called Glorious Revolution that brings William and Mary to power, and that it puts in place a stable parliamentary system, stable courts that were mostly free of corruption, and also allows financial markets to emerge. So then you have financiers who are looking around for good innovators, and those groups of people come together in places like London.
This is a time when you see unleashed all those innovations that are truly in the disruptive end of the spectrum of innovations. This is when we see what the economist Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction. Creative destruction sounds like a paradox. Can you explain how it works?
Well, the idea of creative destruction is that societies often advance through the destruction of old worlds and the creation of new inventions. But those who fall on the wrong side of creative destruction are understandably a little aggrieved by this. So you have large protests by cotton weavers over this period. You have the so-called Peterloo Massacre, in which protesting cotton weavers were killed in 1819. And the backlash against innovation through the so-called Luddites, rallying under the mythical figure of Ned Ludd. People whose livelihoods are affected aren't wrong about the effect that innovation will have. But on aggregate, the impact of the Industrial Revolution is seismic. Suddenly you see per-person living standards beginning to rise, and they haven't stopped rising since, Richard. And that begins in the late 1700s in England, but spreads across Europe and then across the world.
One of the innovations we can all get behind and say hip, hip, hooray about is the invention of the flush toilet. Now, this is said to have been done by a man with the wonderful name of Thomas Crapper. What's the real story behind Thomas Crapper's invention of the flush toilet that you have in your book, Andrew?
Thomas Crapper was a great publicist who managed to convince a whole lot of people that he had been responsible for the flush toilet. But in fact, the design had been described centuries earlier and had been put in place decades earlier. So Crapper improves fittings, stamps his name on cisterns, but effectively the work had been done before him. It also turns out that the word crap is unrelated to Thomas Crapper.
It is.
It had been used centuries beforehand. It means chaff or waste. Though, of course, with a name like Crapper, you can understand why his name is becomes inextricably linked to the development of the toilet.
When we get into modernism, we get a whole other set of innovations which improve things, increase productivity, which mixed blessings to some degree. We get to people like the engineer Frederick Taylor, the time and motion specialist. How did he reinvent the way people work?
So Taylor has the idea that if you can measure things, you're able to push through more efficiency out of factories. He's operating in the Bethlehem Steel Plant in Pennsylvania at the very end of the 1800s. And he tells the story of a labourer who he refers to as Schmidt, where Taylor says that he taught him the science of shoveling pig iron and managed to get him to move far more pig iron per day than others had done. He said you had to optimise every tiny movement. And that notion of Taylorism was the idea that you could get more productivity out of workers if you micromanaged how they operated. But he was pretty patronising. I mean, he said his ideal labour more nearly resembles in his mental makeup the ox. And he probably played no small part in the growth of trade unions, which pushed back against this sort of micromanagement of the work environment.
Was there a price to be paid in terms of innovation from this innovation? Is it a bit inimical to tinkering, the very thing that unleashes further innovation?
It is indeed. It treats workers as being mere human robots rather than being agents who themselves can come up with great innovations. And it's in contrast to a way in which an innovative firm like Toyota tends to try and get improvement by asking workers to suggest ways in which they think firms can be more productive. The idea of continuous improvement driven by the workforce, I think, has a lot more efficiency out of it. And it's also a much more kind and decent way for employers to treat their workforce.
When you peg out how transformative innovations really start to slot into the whole course of human history, by the time we hit the 20th century, they seem to be happening every 5 minutes or so. You get all these new things that we're all well familiar with, like motor transport, planes, the skyscraper, and everything else. We see, and maybe this is the first time, you have a kind of a massive whole of government push to create an innovation. The major one of these is the Manhattan Project to produce the atom bomb, and the Apollo moon missions as well. These are massive coordinated acts of innovation by governments across many branches of government with billions of dollars spent. Have we had anything comparable since those two gigantic all-of-government initiatives? Maybe the COVID vaccine? I don't know, Andrew.
I mean, the Manhattan Project really was remarkable. It was employing 1 in 500 Americans at its peak. It's a project which drew in a whole lot of diverse people and as part of an interdisciplinary collaboration to create the atomic bomb, and which ultimately finished World War II early. I guess in the case of the COVID vaccine, what you have is huge government involvement in rolling out the vaccines, less so than a large team involved in the initial innovation. Indeed, it is striking the extent to which those RNA pioneers had laid the groundwork for a rapid development of a COVID vaccine in a time that I think many of us just thought would be impossible.
Arguably, the most important innovator of the whole of the 20th century is a man hardly anyone's ever heard of. Matt Bevan's just done an excellent podcast on this. A man named Norman Borlaug. Tell me about Norman Borlaug.
So Norman Borlaug perhaps saved more lives than anyone who ever lived. He was an agricultural innovator who lay behind the Green Revolution. He was involved in wheat breeding, first in Mexico and then in Bengal and India and Iran and Turkey. And he built, through successive breeding, plants which were much hardier, able to withstand stem rust and able to produce far more. So his short-stemmed wheat varieties produced far higher yields, and he was very open to the idea that these new innovations needed to be shared across boundaries and that improving the take-up of good agricultural innovation was just as important as coming up with the good seeds themselves.
There were all these dire predictions before he came along as well. That book, The Population Bomb, came out, which predicted that was going to be this awful, catastrophic global famine where millions and millions, maybe a billion people were going to be sort of wiped off the face of the earth when we realised that the earth couldn't sustain that larger population. That just turned that whole narrative around.
It did indeed. I mean, The Population Bomb is an appalling book.
Yeah, it is.
Paul and Ann Ehrlich are arguing in 1968 that the battle to feed humanity is over. They say we should stop giving food aid to India. Inevitably, hundreds of millions of people are going to starve. And they don't anticipate the Green Revolution, that innovation spark by Borlaug and others, which, under one estimate, saved a billion people from starvation.
When we talk about the computer revolution, there's an interesting little episode I can't help but note that in the history of Apple Computer, the Macintosh, the Apple Macintosh came when Apple was actually focused on producing something else, a new computer called the Lisa. which in the long run turned out to be a dud. Steve Jobs had been relegated at that point to a Skunk Works team that was developing Option B, which was the Macintosh. And he went in to see what Xerox PARC was doing with the graphical user interface, decided to copy that for a Macintosh. I wonder if this tells you something about where innovation comes from and sometimes how it's good to have a plan B in place like the Macintosh.
Jobs is remarkable because he's drawing on so many different areas. So the Mac has proportionally spaced fonts, which we now take for granted, but were quite unusual at the time, merely as a result of Jobs having dropped in on a calligraphy class a decade earlier and developing a love of beautiful typography. He wanted the Mac to look beautiful, and that was a big attraction to many buyers. But he also just wanted it to be easy to use. You know, I imagine those who've come of age in the last couple of decades won't ever remember the MS-DOS C prompt, which used to confront many of us when we turned on our computers. Mm. Suddenly, the graphical user interface and the mouse meant that you were in a point-and-click world rather than a world of having to type code commands.
One of the most depressing things about the movie Aliens, Andrew, was that it seemed like in the future people would still be using MS-DOS all years later and have really grainy, low-grade video cameras. Well, that didn't happen, which was a dystopian future that never happened. I was speaking earlier about these kind of giant all-of-government projects to build the atom bomb and then to send people to the moon that the United States had a genius for doing back in the day. Something like this should have been done long ago to produce cheap renewable energy. We're sort of just getting there right now where renewable energy is cheaper than the alternatives. And this is a marvellous thing, but it feels like we should have got there 20 years ago. Does this tell us how powerful incumbents like the fossil fuel industry can react when they feel threatened and actually constrain further innovation?
Yes, there's certainly a danger of incumbents pushing back on innovation, and that happens worst when they have a monopoly over particular areas or where in which governments have a monopoly over the production of things. So you see an early surge in renewables in the form of water wheels, which emerge right across Europe in the period of the 1100s and the 1200s. And we've seen a bit of that innovation happening in solar in recent years. Solar's really been the renewables innovation that's taken off fastest, in part because you have these quite standardised cells, and the quality of those cells has increased extraordinarily. We've seen the innovation in the efficiency of solar cells then driving massive uptake as prices have dropped by a factor of 500 since the mid-1970s.
Again, China seems to be picking up the slack here. China doesn't have a dog in the fight in wanting to preserve fossil fuels, and just the reverse, don't they? They can secure energy independence because they're not an oil-rich nation by developing renewable energy, where the United States does not. It seems to be that they have a kind of a competitive advantage in not having access to fossil fuels in this case.
I think all countries have an advantage in getting access to cheap energy. Cheap energy is such an enabler of innovation across the rest of the society, not to mention beneficial to those who have to pay the electricity bills. And so that's why you're seeing solar rolling out across much of the world, and indeed in parts of Africa, even preceding the electricity distribution networks. So one of the advantages of solar is that energy is being produced in the place it's being consumed. And so if you can have a battery system in place, sometimes you can effectively be off the grid. Just as mobile networks have leapfrogged landline networks in parts of Africa, we're now seeing the same happen with energy through solar and battery setups.
You say something really interesting in your book. You say that many organisations could boost productive tinkering by cutting email time and freeing up time and space for deep work, which would bring about an end to multitasking madness. I say amen to that, brother. But tell me a little bit more about this idea, because I think this sounds quite wonderful.
Well, in this, I'm just backing off the wonderful ideas of Cal Newport, who's a productivity scholar, who's pointed out that the effective job description for many white-collar workers is email answerer. And as a result of becoming email answerers, we've lost the ability to sit back and work on big, important projects. And that matters not only in the corner suite, but also on the factory floor. Cal Newport talks about the way in which computer programmers are trying to solve this with so-called sprint methodology, in which you have two programmers sitting side by side working uninterrupted on a single project. And he advocates firms trying to think about revamping the production technologies in order to provide workers more time for uninterrupted work, and says it's a bit like their factories were reconfigured as a result of electrification. So too, offices need to be reconfigured to take account of the distracting potential of email.
Just to sort of return to the double-edged sword that is innovation, there is this theory that the reason we've never apparently encountered extraterrestrial civilizations is a principle that says that when intelligent life has arisen in the past, somewhere in the galaxy, in the universe, it inevitably innovates its way to extinction. It eventually harnesses too much power. One day someone gets too careless or malicious. You get a Cuban Missile Crisis without the happy ending. And that's it. What do you think of that scenario? Is that too pessimistic for you?
Well, it's certainly true, Richard, that the biggest catastrophic risks that humanity faces right now are our own inventions. The atomic bomb, synthetic biology, and artificial intelligence.
I think you have to throw all that carbon that's in the atmosphere too, don't we?
I think that's incredibly dangerous. In terms of its potential to wipe out humanity, it's probably less of a risk, although clearly climate change is making lives worse in many parts of the planet. But those catastrophic risks are something we need to be concerned about, and we need to think about, for example, gain-of-function research and synthetic biology in which bad bugs are engineered to be even worse, or recursive self-improvement and artificial intelligence in which systems are able to keep on improving themselves, potentially busting through the superintelligence barrier. If we were able to put those guardrails around them and able to constrain the spread of nuclear weapons, then I think we're in a good place through sensibly building guardrails that allow us to go ahead and then build the highway.
You're in governments. Are governments talking about these risks in private and public, in international forums?
They certainly are. I mean, climate change, obviously, through the IPCC, nuclear proliferation through various international accords. Synthetic biology and artificial intelligence are developing their own conversations, and the Brits have led on artificial intelligence through a series of conferences that came out of Bletchley Park a couple of years ago. Those conversations are important, as are the institutions of scholars who are thinking about these kinds of risks. Not because they're anti-innovation, but because they recognise, just as you've said, that we get the very best innovation if we're able to have safety systems in place in which people don't fear that innovations are going to be destructive of our way of life.
It's been fascinating speaking with you, Andrew, as it always is. I am appalled you didn't include the chocolate donut as a kind of world-changing innovation in your book, but clearly these are subjective things. That's not the book I would have written, but nonetheless, that's your prerogative. It's been wonderful speaking with you, and thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Richard.
Andrew Lee's book is called The Shortest History of Innovation. Today's conversation was made on the lands of the Gadigal and the Ngunnawal peoples. Producer was Jennifer Leake. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.